Welcome to the Next Level Human Podcast. As a human, you have a job to do. In fact, you have four jobs: to earn and manage money, to attain and maintain health and fitness, to build and sustain personal relationships, to find meaning and make a difference. None of these jobs are taught in school, and that is what this podcast is designed to do: to educate us all on living our most fulfilled lives through the mastery of these four jobs. I'm your host, Dr. Jade Tita, and I believe we are here living this life for three reasons and three reasons only: to learn, to teach, and to love. In this podcast, I will be learning, teaching, and loving right along with you. I'm grateful to have your company. Here's to our next level. Welcome to today's show, everybody. This is the final installment of a three-part series on female-specific metabolism. As you've heard, I have been doing the inaugural launch of my brand new professional certification for advanced metabolism and female hormones, specifically as it pertains to fat loss and optimizing metabolic function for women. It's really, to my knowledge, a first of its kind in the industry for professionals. This is an area that has been woefully underrepresented. There are very few professionals who understand this. I think I shared with you previously that it was not until 2001, just 20 years ago, that the mandating and regulating bodies started to see that there was an issue in the fact that women were drastically underestimated in the research on metabolism and drugs and health and fitness, that most of this information was being extrapolated from young college age boys. And so I have set out to essentially change this, since I have built my whole career almost over working with women and understanding the hormonal aspects of the female physiology. And I've shared with you a little bit how this really came to me by accident as an ignorant and arrogant male in my 20s. I certainly had no idea the differences between women. And I think a lot of men and women in the professional ranks, trainers, doctors, nutritionists, nurses, etc., still feel that way. And the reason they feel that way is because the rhetoric is still that. The information has not reached the masses yet. There are not enough experts teaching this. And there's two sort of sides to this, right? The one side is one group of people saying that, you know, women should not train or be seen any different than men. And part of this is understandable because the research is cloudy. Each woman has a unique hormonal fingerprint. So it's very difficult to tease out when you take a group of women trying to tease out their different menstrual cycles when none of them are exactly the same. And so it's tough. And I understand that. On the other side of things, we're getting a rash of professionals coming on saying women shouldn't do keto, women shouldn't do intermittent fasting, women shouldn't do this, treating all women as if they're the same. The truth is that women are not men, and all women are different. And so there's a nuance to this. The idea that we're going to say all women should never do any intense exercise or go on keto or do intermittent fasting or any of these things is ludicrous. It's just a silly way to look at it. Just as we would not say women are men, we shouldn't try to make these broad sweeping statements about women. I go through this science in depth. You're really getting two courses in one in this certification. And by the way, I am opening up this certification and this course to everyone, not just professionals. And the reason why is because I know many of you who listen to this podcast are the go-to experts for your tribe. That you're the one that they're asking the information of. You're the one who's educating them. And so whether you're a true professional working with patients or clients or not, I am going to allow everyone to take this course and certification. And it's really two courses in one. The first course is an advanced science of metabolism. This is a science that is brand new. Some of it we only have discovered and really understood in the last year or so. In 2020, you know, we've started to understand some of these things. The mechanisms by which exercise does not work for weight loss. We suspected this for some time. Now we really understand it. We really know it does not work for weight loss at all, actually, and can actually backfire on you. That information, that science, is in this course, and then specifically the ways that you can address female metabolism. Now, in the last two episodes, the first episode we covered the ancestral woman, paleo woman in a sense, giving us context for how to view metabolism in the context of historical woman's stress and sort of the way that historical females and the ancestral woman's metabolism evolved. In the second session last week, we talked about the menstrual cycle and the basic physiology of estrogen and progesterone. And I introduced to you this concept of estrogen and progesterone as two non-identical twin sisters, very much reliant on each other, having a lot of overlapping personality, but also distinct in their functions. And we talked about this idea of how you can use this information to begin to work with women. Now, one of the questions that comes up is, and it's the most important question, and I save the best for last, is the question of, okay, Jade, what about menopause? You've talked about the ancestral woman. You've talked about sort of, you know, premenopausal women and the hormonal fluctuations. What goes on at menopause? Why do so many menopausal women find themselves gaining weight and fat specifically around the belly? And yes, this is a very real thing. It is in the research. Women at menopause, in and around menopause, seem to gain weight despite any conscious change in their nutrition, and it seems to be centered around the midsection. In other words, they lose the hourglass shape. And I do want to say something about the hourglass shape really quickly, because I have gotten several messages from women, rightly so, telling me that they don't like the way I'm using hourglass. And I agree with them. So bear with me. Let's talk about this first, because I think I have not done a good job explaining what exactly do I mean by the hourglass shape. The rightly pointed out issue is that, hey, Jade, all women are different. They're built different. They're all beautiful. And not everyone has an hourglass shape. By saying, you know, this idea that the hourglass shape is the most beautiful shape on a woman, aren't you not being very sensitive to the idea that women are all very different? Well, the hourglass shape actually accounts for this. And so while when I say the hourglass shape, many people will picture, you know, this, you know, supermodel type of woman who is very curvy, right? You know, sort of voluptuous up top and sort of hippie on the bottom. And this would be essentially how people would see the hourglass shape. And the truth is, this is not really what I mean by the hourglass shape. The hourglass shape I am talking about is the hourglass shape that I read about in the research. And it really has to do with a comparison between the waist to hip ratio and the waist to chest ratio. And so what you would do is you'd measure your waist at the smallest portion above the hip bone and below the rib cage. And then you would also measure the waist at the widest protrusion of the waist. And then you would measure the bust, the breast, usually wearing a sports bra or some kind of bra. And then you would compare these. And typically, the normal woman is going to be somewhere between 0.6 and 0.9 in both the waist to chest and the waist to hip ratio. And if she falls in this range, whether or not, let's say she's 0.67 waist to chest, and let's say 0.76 waist to hip. This is still in the range of an hourglass shape, although you might not necessarily look at her and see her as an hourglass shape. You might say, okay, well, she's a little bit more, let's say, of a pear shape. But there's still an hourglass shape in this woman compared to a man. Now, of course, once you start going out of that 0.6 to 0.9 ratio, that hourglass shape starts to become distorted a little bit. And this is where you start getting fat accumulation all down below the pear shape, or fat accumulation sort of in the middle. And so the thing I really actually like about the hourglass shape that I am, you know, not doing a very good job of explaining is that it actually is a measure that takes into account the different shapes of women. Not every one woman is going to have a perfect hourglass shape. Actually, in the research, they will look at models, even thin models and sort of plus size models, and they will find that models, whether they're thin and appear to the eye as being more stick figure like, or whether they're more plus size and curvy, they do stick to a pretty even distribution of hourglass. And the perfect hourglass would be 0.7 and 0.7. That's optimal. But the point is not to say women should have 0.7 and 0.7 and be in hourglass shape. The point is that most women already are in hourglass shape, despite what it might outwardly appear like. And that the more you stick to that hourglass shape, the more that hourglass shape starts to disappear, the less healthy that you're going to be. And when I use the term the most attractive shape, actually, and the research is very clear on this, I mean three things by this. I mean attractive to the woman herself. When the woman looks in the mirror and has an hourglass shape, she is more attractive to herself. She rates her body as more favorable to herself. Likewise, when other females who are not romantically interested in women look at that woman, they admire her physique as well. And yes, when romantically interested men or women who are romantically interested in women see those women, they also find that's attractive. So when I say the most attractive shape, it's the most attractive shape to the individual woman who has that shape. It's the most attractive shape as measured by other women admiring that particular woman who are heterosexual woman. And it's also the most attractive shape to people who are romantically inclined towards women. That's what I mean. So the hourglass shape actually takes this into account. So I hope that's clear. Now, at menopause, this hourglass shape begins to turn more into the apple shape. So the waist to chest ratio and the waist to hip ratio begin to rise because the waist measurement goes up while the hip stays the same and the bust stays the same, or at least it goes up more. And these women start to gain weight. And so there is a weight gain usually around the perimenopausal period, and it has to do with a change in shape from hourglass more to apple. And we're going to talk a little bit about this physiology today. Now, really, people think of menopause as all one thing. Menopause is really three things: perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. And ironically, menopause is just a very narrow space that occurs between perimenopause and postmenopause. Most of menopause, as women think about it, is occurring during the perimenopause period. And this perimenopause period can last years, if not a decade or more. For example, a woman can begin going into perimenopause in her late 30s, early 40s, and not complete perimenopause until her mid-50s or so. And this is important to understand because most of the time when we're talking about the symptoms of menopause, things like hot flashes, anxiety, insomnia, vaginal dryness, mood changes, cravings, energy reductions, all of these kinds of things, we are normally talking about the perimenopausal period. Menopause is actually a clinical diagnosis. There's two ways to really diagnose menopause. One is a 12-month period of time where there was no menses. This is typically what is defined by menopause. And usually someone will confirm this, or a doctor will confirm this, by running an FSH test, follicle stimulating hormone, FSH, that normally if it is above 30 milli international units per milliliter, then this essentially constitutes menopause when it also comes along with a cessation of menses. Now, one of the interesting things just to note is in perimenopause, this long period of time, women can get pregnant during this time. Perimenopause really will start there, is this period of time where the follicle, which holds the egg for many reasons, aging is the major reason here, from, you know, stress and just depending on the number of viable follicles each woman has genetically, the follicles begin to become less and or less viable. What's that mean? It means that under the influence of estrogen, these follicles aren't maturing as they once did, either because there are less of them and or they are not as healthy follicles. And what ends up or there is declining hormone levels for any number of reasons, like let's say for declining hormones in general. And actually, this can happen in younger women. In fact, every menstrual period, every time a woman who is premenstrual, younger women, every time she menstruates, she is going into what constitutes a mini menopause. Think about it. Menses pausing basically is what we're talking about here. Ultimately, the hormone system resets at every menstrual cycle. Estrogen and progesterone fall. This is a mini menopause that every single woman, even younger women, go through. Now, as you start going through perimenopause, what ends up happening is the follicle, which contains the egg, does not mature adequately, and therefore the luteinizing hormone surge, along with other endocrine and nervous system signals, does not actually rupture and release the egg from the follicle. And therefore, if the egg is not released from the follicle and that follicle does not rupture, there is no creation of the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum is the source of progesterone. And this is where you start getting into perimenopause. You're having menstrual cycles where sometimes there is no ovulation. And if there is no ovulation, there is no progesterone. And remember, if this is getting confusing for you, go back to the last episode, the one before this one. I think it's episode 104, I believe. This is 105, or maybe this is 104 and it's 103. I believe this is episode 105 and the last one, episode 104. Go check on that one so you can see the normal endocrinology of what happens here with the menstrual cycle. The formation of the corpus luteum is the source of progesterone. And that only happens if the follicle releases the egg, because the follicle is what becomes the corpus luteum. So perimenopause is a hallmark of low progesterone in a sense, or no progesterone. It is not being maintained. Now, last time we talked about the idea of these two non-identical twin sisters being reliant on each other. And we talked about the idea that progesterone is the conservative sister, the worrying sister, the sister that wants to take it easy and plan for the future and keeps estrogen in check. Estrogen needs her sister progesterone so that estrogen can go out and attack the world without getting into much trouble. So what happens when progesterone levels fall or there is no ovulation at times? And by the way, in perimenopause, sometimes there's ovulation, sometimes there is not. And so maybe a woman goes three cycles without ovulation, but then gets ovulation on another cycle. What this constitutes is a progesterone deficient time. And what does this do to her sister estrogen? It makes her sister estrogen very volatile. Sometimes if you measure estrogen at perimenopause, it's sky high. And other times if you measure estrogen at perimenopause, it's very low. And this is why you can get all kinds of changes. Now remember, estrogen is a feel-good hormone because it amplifies serotonin, the self-esteem hormone. It also is an ambition and drive hormone because it amplifies dopamine. And so if there are times when estrogen is very high, you can feel almost manic and almost like life is great. Let's attack life. I feel good. I feel like my old self again. And then when at times when estrogen is low, you can feel utterly depressed. So it can feel a lot like bipolar in the head, manic depressive. Bipolar is the new term for manic depressive, where one minute you feel up, the next minute you feel crash. And the same thing can happen with the metabolism. One minute you're eating the one diet, the exact same diet, and it's putting weight on you because estrogen sensitizes the body to insulin. So when it's a little bit higher, you're getting some good effects there with that particular diet. And then the same diet can lead to issues later because estrogen that is low is making you more insulin resistant. And so it can feel very, very volatile during this time. So you might say, okay, Jade, I get it. I understand this. What can we do here with perimenopause? This period of time where progesterone is deficient an awful lot of the time and estrogen is, you know, throwing a temper tantrum. 1 minute is up, 1 minute is down, and you don't know what to do about this. Well, there are things to do, and there's several different moves to make. The first move to make is to understand what progesterone does. Progesterone helps regulate estrogen. And so in a sense, progesterone is priming the estrogen receptors in many tissues in the body, including in the thermostat, the hypothalamus, the command and control center of the metabolism. So are there things that we can do that progesterone naturally does? Well, first of all, progesterone together with estrogen is a very balancing hormone. So another analogy to think about is think about estrogen and progesterone, these two twin sisters on a seesaw. Think about estrogen on one side of the seesaw in a pink dress and progesterone on the other side of the seesaw in a blue dress. And imagine they're playing seesaw, but progesterone starting to get tired. Maybe even progesterone sort of goes to sleep. Well, to keep the seesaw going, estrogen has to work extra hard. Then she tires out, fatigues, and she's low. And then she gets her energy again and she comes back on and she starts working hard again. This is partly what is happening with the estrogen situation here. And so one of the things you need to do is step in as a sense as the mother and do some of the calming and stress reducing activity that progesterone would have done naturally. Think about though what normally happens with a woman at perimenopause. What normally happens is she may start gaining weight. She may start feeling not herself. Her moods may change. Cravings and hunger and energy start to fluctuate like crazy. Especially inability to sleep is a big one, which in itself makes women more insulin resistant due to effects on leptin and other hormones, leptin and ghrelin, causing women to want to overeat at times. All of this stuff starts to happen here as it regards to these changes in progesterone and estrogen. If a woman wants to help this, she needs to step in and do the opposite of what she thinks. What she typically thinks and is told is she needs to double down. She needs to have more willpower. She needs to work harder. She needs to do more exercise, eat even less, be even more diligent, right? This whole willpower argument, work harder. The truth is that is not going to work here, because one of the things you need to understand is that both eating too much and exercising too much and eating too little and exercising too little, those extremes are stress to the body. I oftentimes talk about the calorie gap, the gap between intake and output, whether you're eating too much and not burning enough, or whether you're burning too much and not eating enough. Both of these are a stress to the system because they create a large calorie gap. That large calorie gap is much more narrow when estrogen and progesterone are playing together. When progesterone goes away, that calorie gap that may not have been stressful previously, that same calorie gap is now more stressful. Sorry to break in. I want to cover one of my sponsors, Organifi. Now, look, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, and many of you who know me well know this, but shockingly, I cannot stand vegetables. I really do not like vegetables. I have not liked them since a child. I think it has something to do with my mom, who cooked everything just boiled everything, no salt, no fat, no taste, period. And so I developed an extreme dislike for almost all vegetables. And still to this day, I have a difficult time getting in my fruits and vegetables. Well, Organifi, started by my good friend Drew Cannoli, who I've developed a relationship over the years, and I am really sort of tickled that we finally get to do this together with Organifi sponsoring the Next Level Human podcast. Drew is a Next Level Human. Organifi is a Next Level Human company. I can't say enough about them. I'm excited for them to be on board as a sponsor for the Next Level Human podcast. My favorite products, let me tell you about them. They have a ton, but I use three pretty much every day. I use Organifi Gold before I go to sleep. This is their turmeric tea based on sort of the old Ayurvedic golden milk. It is absolutely fantastic. It contains lots of different relaxing herbs, turmeric,
taste wonderful. And one of the things this has done for me is I had a very bad wine habit at night. It started out as just one glass of wine. Lately, it's turned into two, three, and sometimes a bottle. What I've done starting in 2021 is use Organifi. This is what I have in lieu of wine. And I sit there just like I used to sit with my wine, and I have the Organifi Gold. I also use the green and red juice powders. I have never liked greens and reds juices, period. These powders to me always tasted like swamp water. I use one scoop of the greens, one scoop of the reds first thing in the morning before my coffee. It has become a ritual over the last several years. It is fantastic. Those are the ones I use the most. Of course, they have a great line of protein products, and they have a new Organifi Gold chocolate, which I have not tried yet, but I cannot wait to try that because you all know I love cocoa powder and use it for lots of different things, for cravings and everything else. Check out Organifi, Organifi.com. Use the code NEXTLEVEL. Please take care of Organifi the same way they're taking care of the earth, doing amazing things as a company, and now taking care of the Next Level Human podcast so we can all be together and have these discussions. Organifi.com, use the code NEXTLEVEL. Let's get back to the show. Here we go. So what you need to do is you need to be more diligent about matching intake and output closer. So if you're used to creating a 30% calorie deficit or cutting carbohydrates down to less than 30 grams, what you're going to have to do is regulate that a little bit and do 10% calorie reduction instead, or find what I would call the carbohydrate tipping point. Not too much, not too little, but just right. Carbohydrates are a really key aspect of this perimenopausal management, because if you go too low, what happens? You release more stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol to raise blood sugar. If you go too high, you got an insulin resistant system, and so you can end up storing more of those carbohydrates as fat. And so you do not want to go too low, and you do not want to go too high, and so you kind of have to find the right amount of carbohydrates. Can you see the difference? It's not a harder approach. It's a much smarter approach. It is more tricky because now you have to find the Goldilocks zone, not too much, not too little, but just right of calories and carbs and exercise. And so one of the best moves that you can do to take this newfound stress off the system, and if you're listening closely, it's a newfound stress. Even if you are doing the exact same lifestyle that have always worked for you, that lifestyle in this new context of not having progesterone and estrogen play well together during perimenopause can now constitute a stress on the system, which is why something has to change. What? This is the tricky part. You might say, well, Jade, what do I change? Do I lower carbs? You may need to lower carbs. You may need to raise carbohydrates a little bit. And this is where this idea of eat less, exercise less, and eat more, exercise more has a huge amount of utility. It's the reason I talk about these. What you don't want to do is eat less, exercise more to a greater extreme, or eat more, exercise less to a greater extreme. You want to regulate this. You want to match more closely intake and output while still creating a calorie deficit. This is why the eat less, exercise less approach and the eat more, exercise more approach are so critical. I covered these in detail in earlier episodes of this particular podcast, but the point is that you need to be in a position where the calorie gap, the amount of gap between intake and output is closed down a little bit. The last thing you want to do is be going crazy with Orange Theory, crazy with CrossFit, crazy with hot Bikram yoga, crazy with long distance running, and all of this kind of stuff. One, we now know pretty much conclusively that exercise is an abysmal strategy for weight loss. The best it does is help maintain more muscle so that you lose more fat, but diet is where it's at. So your whole focus has to get shifted to being very, very diligent with diet. And then perhaps as important, if not more important, is to play the role of mother when progesterone now is gone. And what that means is to calm the system down, to focus on rest and relaxation. This is the most important aspect of perimenopause. Going from an hour extra on the treadmill to an hour extra in bed. Going from a 30-minute intense Metcon at CrossFit to
a nice, long, leisurely nap. Going from, you know, an extra spin class to, you know, making love to your partner. Everything that relaxes you. Spa time. Creative pursuits. I talk about these things a lot, but let's go through them really quickly. Spending time in green settings. Nature lowers cortisol and stress hormones. It helps do what progesterone would do for you. Time socializing with really good friends. So long as you're not abusing food and alcohol and stuff like that, is important. That lowers stress hormone. Time with pets, so long as they're not peeing and pooping all over the place. Time with your significant other, so long as it is a loving relationship. And sex and orgasm is huge here because it has some of these nice, calming, relaxing effects. And people don't want to talk about this, but it's absolutely huge. Whether it's orgasm through masturbation or whether it's coupled orgasm, orgasm, sex, physical affection, that whole area is calming and relaxing and is a wonderful thing to be doing to balance out what progesterone might have been doing. Creative pursuits are fantastic. They've even shown doodling, coloring, painting, music is fantastic. And listening to music, especially relaxing music, especially things like classical music, seems to have a nice relaxing effect on most people. Walking, but not power walking. Relaxing, leisurely or leisurely walking. This is absolutely huge and needs to become the dominant form of activity right around perimenopause to lower cortisol and at menopause, which we'll get to in a minute, when estrogen goes away to sensitize the body to insulin. Walking needs to become your mantra, your religion as you come into menopause. Sauna therapies. They raise stress hormones while you're in the sauna, but have a refractory period where they actually lower cortisol. And by the way, exercise also is incredibly, has the same refractory period. The issue though is that you need to be conditioned to what you're doing. So let's say you're a woman who is conditioned and you've been a runner your whole life. I'm not saying stop running. Actually, that is having some benefits from you. What I'm saying is perhaps run a little less or run the same. Don't start running more and start adding lots of recovery activities. Contrast hydrotherapies, cold exposures, hot exposures, these thermal exposures, time in a sauna, then time in a cold dipping pool. These things do the same thing. They stimulate cortisol and stress hormones in the short run, but they have a eustress effect as long as they're short-lived, and this hormetic effect where they actually then make you more resistant to stress later. Things like spa, you know, getting your nails done, getting a massage, self-massage, foam rolling, all of these kind of things. Anything that gives you that sort of awe experience. Ah, meaning A-H-H-A or A-H-H-H, ah, anything that gives you that ah experience, and anything that gives you the awe, A-W-E experience. These are things like orgasm. These are things like being out in nature, watching sunsets, listening to music, having an amazing conversation, creating something beautiful. All of these things are calming, and these are the things that you want to begin focusing on. And one of the things here that I'll show that is perhaps most important, which is why I mainly have pivoted much of my work now into the self-development arena, and because purpose and meaning is the one thing, the single most important thing that I would say, and we see this in the research, that buffers against stress, a deep, meaningful purpose, and knowing the difference between meaning and purpose, which I have covered in the past at past episodes. And you'll want to understand that because this becomes perhaps your number one way of reducing stress. So at perimenopause, you understand the physiology. Now you essentially have to be in a position where you really, really, really take self-care to the extreme and begin to take it seriously. And do not, I can't say do not enough, over exercise. Exercise just enough. If you want to overdo anything, and even that can become too much, it's leisurely or leisurely walking. Walk as much as you can, exercise only just enough, and do all these other things to round it out. And what you're doing is you are acting as the progesterone sister, and this will calm the system down and also help estrogen work for you. Now, as you go into menopause, what ends up happening is now you're beginning to lose estrogen as well. And so I oftentimes talk about estrogen and progesterone like Joan of Arc, right? In her full suit of metal. The suit of armor is estrogen because it's more powerful and more protective in a sense. It has dual action, which is why it's the armor. One, it sensitizes the body to insulin. Two, it blocks the effects of cortisol. And so it's the suit of armor. Progesterone has a negative effect on insulin, but a positive effect on cortisol. This is why it's the shield. So Joan of Arc is standing there with her suit of armor on. She's also holding a shield and a sword. The sword is testosterone. Testosterone in women has a lot to do with libido. It has effects on mood and ambition and drive, and works with estrogen to make women feel powerful and secure and self-oriented and have self-esteem. And what ends up happening at menopause or at perimenopause is the shield is knocked out of Joan of Arc's hand. What happens at menopause is now she has lost her suit of armor as well. And what a lot of people don't know is that the ovaries also produce testosterone, but there is some indication, and this is an area that I'm watching with interest and other people who are interested in female hormones are watching, there is some potential information that says that despite estrogen and progesterone being lowered, testosterone is lowered too, but perhaps the ovaries, due to testosterone acting as somewhat of a stress hormone in women, meaning that it likes to be released along with cortisol to help buffer against stress, that the testosterone level, despite falling along with estrogen and progesterone at menopause, may be still there more so than estrogen and progesterone. In other words, if you understand the difference between relative amounts and absolute amounts, absolutely speaking, progesterone, estrogen, and testosterone all fall at menopause compared to what they were previously. However, relatively speaking, estrogen and progesterone dominated during premenopausal time, and now they're not dominating perhaps as much. So the testosterone influence starts to manifest itself a little more. And believe it or not, this is one of the reasons why you start seeing a shift of fat to the midsection on women. What we know in younger women who are under high stress is that the waist to hip and the waist to chest ratio rises. In other words, they become more of an apple shape, women who are very stressed. And we can see that these younger women have a unique hormonal profile. It's lower progesterone and estrogen, which is similar to what happens at menopause. It's higher cortisol and insulin and slightly higher testosterone, relatively speaking, compared to estrogen and progesterone. And so testosterone may be slightly elevated at menopause and postmenopause. And so with this Joan of Arc analogy we're using, estrogen gets knocked away, or progesterone gets knocked away is the shield at perimenopause. Then the armor gets knocked off at menopause, and the woman is left with, let's say, a sword, but a shorter sword. She still has a sword, but maybe it got broken and she only has half a sword now, but she still has a little bit of that testosterone kicking around, which is why her physique moves a little bit away from the hourglass shape and a little bit more into the more block shape like a man, or apple shape, sort of shape. So this is important. So what do you do here? Well, we talked about already the stress reducing stuff in perimenopause. You want to keep doing that. But now that estrogen is gone, remember, it has dual roles, anti-stress and anti-insulin, or I'm sorry, and pro-insulin. Now what needs to happen is a more insulin-centered approach, making sure that you are mitigating estrogen to, or insulin to some degree. And that means managing carbohydrates and perhaps even in some women, managing protein a little bit as well. In other words, dialing back carbohydrates if you were eating most of that stuff, or ramping up carbohydrates a little bit more if you weren't eating them at all. Now, this is confusing, so I'll stop here. You might say, well, Jade, how does that work? Because there are two ways to become insulin resistant. The first way is to overeat calories, mainly in the form of protein and carbohydrates, mainly carbohydrates. Fat doesn't have the same effect on insulin. So overeating calories as carbs first and protein second is one way to become insulin resistant. The other way to become insulin resistant is to increase the stress and have cortisol levels rise. Cortisol can make you independently insulin resistant because it antagonizes insulin and the insulin receptors and does a number of different things in the brain and has wide-reaching effects that can make people insulin resistant. And when you cut out carbs too much, you'll raise cortisol levels and insulin levels to try to reduce or raise blood sugar by the reduction of glycogen. This is how the body does it. You have storage forms of carbohydrate, glycogen in the liver. You have it in the muscle too, but you can't use that for blood sugar, only the glycogen in the liver. So what ends up happening is cortisol will and adrenaline will cause that glycogen to be broken down so the body gets its blood sugar. It also will cause, if there is no glycogen in the liver, even more of it will be released and cause amino acids that are mainly coming from either the diet or the muscle tissue to be used in gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis, glucose, new making, basically making new sugar, making blood sugar. So high amounts of cortisol due to complete carbohydrate withdrawal can, in some women, not all, raise cortisol and adrenaline to such a degree that they antagonize insulin. So this is really about finding the carbohydrate tipping point. But for most women, it is about moving from a calorie counting approach to more of a carbohydrate managing approach. So at perimenopause, it's stress reducing. At menopause, it's reducing the amount of carbohydrates for most women. But I did want to give you the full picture. It's not as simple as just cutting carbs back. This is why ketogenic diets can backfire and very low carb diets can backfire. One caveat in clinical pearl I can give you here is if you are going to reduce carbohydrates pretty significantly, then you're probably going to want to ramp up protein in their place because protein is a little bit like a flex fuel. Yes, it will raise insulin, but it will do it less than carbohydrates and it can also lower cortisol levels. So protein is a good move here. You don't want to go completely low in carbs, but you're probably going to want to reduce them somewhat as a percent of calories. That's the second move. So now we got two things that we want to do here. One, stress management at perimenopause. Two, carbohydrate management at menopause. And then the final part of this story, and then we'll wrap up this series, is what do we do postmenopause? Well, we potentially have a situation where we can use this extra testosterone. You don't really have extra testosterone. In fact, many women will be told by their doctors that they're low, and they are low. And many women will even perhaps be given testosterone, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but you'll be more in a relative testosterone state. One of the benefits, by the way, of taking testosterone as a menopausal woman is that there's a conversion that moves testosterone into estrogen. So many women who feel better on testosterone are feeling better on testosterone because it's being aromatized by the aromatase enzyme into estrogen. And so it's a 2-for-1 situation. If you're given testosterone supplementally, your doctor gives it to you, you're also getting an estrogen kick. So you're getting this testosterone and estrogen, which makes you back into that, you know, more self-esteem oriented person, feeling better about life, stabilizes mood, raises libido again, makes you feel like yourself again. And testosterone definitely can do this. But now that you're in a more relative testosterone state, it may not be the best thing for your physique. And so what you want to do is use that testosterone to make sure you're building lean tissue, muscle, and also burning some of the fat that you might be accumulating. And one of the things that happens here at menopause, perimenopause, postmenopause, cravings, hunger sometimes are so relentless that you unconsciously overeat. Well, weight training is the one thing that can use testosterone to build muscle and can also result in using any extra excess calories to be stored as muscle and not fat. And so now we have this three-pronged approach rounded out. Number one, at perimenopause, stress management, huge. Number two, at menopause, carbohydrate control. And number three, at postmenopause, making sure you're getting some resistance training in. And so what ends up happening is the menopausal state, when we think about perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause all at the same time, we're really talking about an exercise approach that is mostly relaxing walking, good quality weight training. And by the way, sorry to say this, I know that you might think it's because I'm a big burly dude who likes to lift weights, but truthfully, the best approach, because I know people are going to ask, well, can I do yoga? Sure, you can. Can I do light dumbbells? Sure, you can. You can do all those things, and it's better, and they are a form of resistance training. However, the best forms of resistance training are really the ones that are using the weights like dumbbells, barbells, kettlebells, etc., and doing them in really the old-fashioned way where you push a little bit, you rest. You push a little bit, you rest. This is hugely important. And so here is the approach at menopause. Now, I know I did not cover certain things that people are going to want to know about. What about hormone replacement therapy, Jade? Should I be on it or not? I'll give you a couple caveats here as we end this podcast. What the research shows conclusively with hormones in general is that they speed up metabolism, right? And so you might think, well, that's a good thing then. But remember, I always say you don't want a fast metabolism. You want a more flexible metabolism. And so do these hormones make women more flexible? What the research actually hints at, and it's not clear, and I know I say that a lot, but I like to be honest about this. I don't know. The research is not 100% clear here, but it hints at two things, one good and one bad, that when you're on hormone replacement therapy, it may actually trend towards making you gain slight amounts of weight. However, it definitely decreases the amount of weight that you store around the middle. So in other words, it may not help you lose weight. It may even make you gain a little bit of weight, but it does keep the female shape on the body. So, and this goes for bioidentical hormone replacement therapy or synthetic hormone replacement therapies. The thing here is that one of the reasons it may make some women gain weight, and the reason it's not clear, is because not everyone has the same response. Whenever you speed up metabolism, you also speed up hunger. So hormone intake, even in a woman's younger years, in terms of contraceptives and stuff like that, many women gain weight off that, not because of the hormones themselves, but because the hormones are having an unconscious upregulation in hunger and cravings. And this is important because people don't understand this. What research shows conclusively is that we humans are terrible, terrible, terrible at counting calories. We think we're eating much less than we are. As an example, if I cut calories by 200 calories a day for 5 days for a total calorie deficit of 1,000 calories, I think I'm doing pretty good because I've got 5 days of calorie reduction. But then I ease up on the weekend and consume 700 calories on Saturday and Sunday each. That gives me 1,400 extra calories. That means that I actually not only made up for the 1,000 calories that I had a deficit of for the 5 days previous, but now I'm in a calorie surplus of 400. Now, in my human brain, I'll think that I had a calorie deficit because I had more days where I didn't eat as much. I had 5 days where I didn't eat as much versus two. Well, the metabolism doesn't think in terms of days. It thinks in terms of weeks and months. And so this is one of the reasons, not to mention the fact that we just underestimate what we eat in general. We forget, we amplify servings, we don't weigh and measure everything. So we actually are eating much more. And this is an important consideration here when you're on HRT, because one of the things that HRT is probably doing is causing you to unconsciously overeat a little bit. And unfortunately, you could go 6 days in calorie deficit. And in today's day and age, because of the quick access to high calorie palatable foods, one Sunday day where you eat a large brunch, a snack all day, and then have a large dinner with alcohol can completely wipe out any calorie deficits that you created over the previous 6 days. And this is part of the issue. And so it's not just part of the issue, by the way. It's a huge issue. And I'll talk more about this in future episodes. But I'm going to end right there today. I hope you enjoyed the 3-part series on female-specific fat loss and hormones and advanced metabolism. Please, if you are interested, if you are a professional, please go and take the free training that teaches you about this advanced metabolism and female hormone, and consider, after watching the free training, please consider becoming certified and taking my course. We need people doing this. It is absolutely ridiculous to me, and the humor is not lost on me. I am not a woman. I have no idea. I've never had menses. I've never gone through pregnancy. I don't know what menopause is like. It is ludicrous in my mind that I am teaching this stuff. We need women doing this. But I say that, and at the same time, there's not enough people doing it, period. So we also need men, but we especially need women mastering this information, being out there teaching it, because they actually have the real lived experience of it as well that I can't possibly have. And yes, we need you men who are professionals. We know a couple things. We know that the vast majority of people who hire doctors, trainers, nutritionists are women. We need to stop treating them as if they are men. And we also need to stop treating young women as if they're the same as mature women. We need to know these hormonal differences. Whether you are a professional in this field or not, even if you are just the go-to person in your tribe that teaches them about this stuff, please consider getting this professional certification so we can take on this issue and really start making a difference for women. The industry is failing miserably. We need all the help we can get. I hope you will join us to get the free training and to be introduced to the offer. Go to http://drjade.com/femalecert. drjade.com/femalecert. Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. We'll be back to our regularly scheduled stuff, and I'll probably do some personal development at the next episode. I so appreciate you all. I hope you enjoyed this 3-part series, and I will see you at the next episode.